Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we dip it about diddly scat diddly woo woo yeah. Just a little bit of jazz for you to start the day. Today we are discussing the epilogue, chapter 2, and then we will be reading the very last chapter of the book. That's pretty excitement, I think. Wouldn't you agree? Pretty excitement. What did you guys have to say about it? Chapter 2 of the epilogue? Oh dear, Grushenka is here. What will happen next? I am Norwegian said. I did buy The Enormous Room a few days ago. I just meant that I'm sticking around at least until we've read the Tolstoy books. Okay, well, I am Norwegian. I'm pretty sure we're reading War and Peace last, so that would mean you're sticking around till the end. Although that's not set in stone, but that was the idea I had. But you know what? It's up to you guys. This is a whole community. I'm at your disposal. Dimitri caught the brain fever from the result of his trial. The trope is getting out of hand. Though he mostly seems like his old dramatic self, constantly oscillating between talk of redemptions or plans of how big a scoundrel he is. He's obsessed with scoundrel. Isn't he? He's obsessed with a scale of the scoundrel scale of 1 to 10 of what amount of scoundrel he is. Who cares about a scoundrelness? That's not a thing, Mitya. That's not a thing. Alyosha shouts angrily for the first time in the book, and the chapter ends with a revelation that Alyosha is dead. I don't know who Alyosha is. It's interesting that while everyone, except the women, seemed out for blood, they are being lenient with Dimitri, seemingly taking pity on him, both in his placement in the hospital, but also with visitation rights. I have to admit that trying to care about the love triangle is difficult at this point. It always has been the least interesting part of the book for me, but especially now that the book is pretty much done, tomorrow's chapter is the last one. Okay, two things. I don't know who Ilyusha is. I know that name has been thrown around a lot in the book, but didn't make enough of an impact on me for me to know who that character is. Also, I did not realize it was a love triangle. I knew that Grushenka was sleeping with both Dimitri and the father, Fyodor. But I wouldn't have called that a love triangle. I think, I don't really know. I don't know what her deal is. I don't think she has real motivations and emotions and I don't know. I don't get it. I don't get this book. Uncle Drosselmeyer said, Kat and Grushenka in the same room. That is a disaster waiting to happen. I can almost hear the snapping sound of high-powered electric fields between those girls. Maybe. I don't know. Why is he in love with a girl who is banging his dad? Why is she so happy to flip-flop between people? Who's Katerina in love with? I thought she was Ivan's wife. No, she was Mitch's wife. Are they married? I don't know. This book's dumb. I hate it. Swim said the Mama Fishy said, it was a surprise to see that James Fenimore Cooper, the last of the Mohicans, reference. I understand that there will still be some Redskins about somewhere on the frontier on the horizon at the last of the Mohicans or something. Well, that's where I want to go, to the frontier, to those Mohicans. Per an answer to the question on Quora, the first American novelist translated into Russian was undoubtedly James Fenimore Cooper in 1831. Alexandra Ishamova translated his novel Red Rover. Other novels followed. Cooper's books, and especially the Pentalogy about Natty Bumppo and Chingachgook the Mohican, would also always be extremely popular among Russian kids. The word Redskin was used by both native and non-native characters in The Last of Mohicans to reference Native Americans. Is that a racial slur nowadays, Redskin? I honestly don't know. We don't really have Native Americans here in Australia. Well, we probably do, but not enough that there's like cultural sensitivity around the language. Dylan's Rule says, I'd just like to say I signed up for this at the beginning of the year, but haven't kept up on the reading. I stayed subscribed to the subreddit in part because I like seeing the progress of books as I scroll. It has seemed like a huge portion of time was spent on Brothers Karamazov. I applaud all of you that made it through. Bravo. Thank you, Dylan's Rule. Much appreciated, dude. It was a slog. I mean, War and Peace was a whole year, 365 chapters. And that felt like far less of a slog than this Brothers Karamazov. Brothers Karamazov was just like crawling through the mud. Whereas at least War and Peace, I remember very often saying like, oh, I really want to read the next chapter straight away. And I had no inkling to want to read on at all at any point of this book. So different, very different. Laura Weistich said, I had actually started the book last year before I knew about the list. I would have finished it eventually, but not this fast for sure. It sure was long. I've enjoyed it, but I'm looking forward to moving on to something new. I'm interested to hear the opinions of people who have read War and Peace before and now have read The Brothers Karamazov, the, you know, magnum opusi of these two contemporaries, Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. There's often a debate, like one versus the other. They're very different, and they're both legends. I want to say I'm a Tolstoy guy, only because I liked War and Peace so much more than The Brothers Karamazov, but then I also read Notes from Underground, and that was really good. And I haven't read Anna Karenina, so I don't know. But out of those two books, definitely War and Peace. I loved War and Peace, and I hated The Brothers Karamazov, so it's a pretty clear line there. I want to tell you guys, I've just republished Aaron Huggins' novel, Live a Little, as an Amazon book, because I know so many of my listeners are in America and the UK, and it's just so much better to buy books, Amazon books, rather than buying them through my website and everything. So I thought, if I do that, I can make it a bit cheaper for you guys, because it's printed and sent by Amazon. You can even get your free shipping if you've got like your Amazon Prime or whatever you've got. I think you can get free shipping with that, don't quote me on that. But however Amazon works, see, Amazon in Australia isn't really a thing. We do have it here, but most of the stuff you buy is sent over from America, especially books. And that's why when I published it locally, I did it through an Australian service. But then that's not ideal for the American and UK and basically everywhere else in the world. So now there's both. There is an international edition. It'll cost you $16.95, which I think is a pretty good deal. American. That's American. And it also means, you know, I want Aaron to have a good experience of having his first book out in the world, so I'd love to be able to go back to him and say, look at all these people around the world that bought your book, and by the way, here's your royalty check. I think that would be pretty cool. So, his book. It's a murder mystery set on an alien planet. The detective is an alien himself. It's a science fiction murder mystery. And it's funny. Think somewhere along the lines of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That kind of humour. It's sci-fi. It's good sci-fi, but it's also funny. And it's a really good murder mystery. So Aaron, from a young age, was obsessed with murder mysteries, Agatha Christie kind of books. And then he always loved his British TV with that quirky humour, Doctor Who, that kind of thing. And he's also has a love of sci-fi. He's mixed all that together. And he's found this really cool little niche. And he started this series about a detective who solves crimes around the galaxy. Live a Little by Aaron Huggins. I will put a link in today's Reddit discussion and a link in the podcast episode description. Otherwise, search for Live a Little by Aaron Huggins on Amazon. You'll be able to find it. It's on Kindle too. That's a little advertisement today. I'm going to be doing that over the next few days because we're starting a new book. We'll have a new influx of listeners. And also, I've just completed an interview for the Launchpad YouTube channel, like a podcast video interview with Aaron, which will be released in the next few days. So we're trying to give his book a little second push around the world. Thanks for listening to that advertisement. Let's read the final chapter of The Brothers Karamazov. Oh, just got to get to it. Oh, by the way, I am tomorrow publishing, hopefully tomorrow, an Amazon and Kindle version, paperback and Kindle ebook, of The Enormous Room by E.E. Cummings. I've gotten around the legal loophole where they said I wasn't allowed to do it anymore. Well, now I am again. How did I get around that loophole? They said, you can print a public domain book, but you have to have something in that book that you own the copyright to. And there was all kinds of different things that you could include. A new translation, which is a hell of a lot of work, so I wasn't going to do that one. Or annotations or things like that. Or illustrations. 5 original illustrations. So I have created 5 original illustrations to be included in the book so that I can print the public domain book, which means you can support the podcast by getting the official The Hemingway List version of the book yet again. I'm going to be backfilling the previous books as well, so they will become available again. But for now, The Enormous Room, The Hemingway List version, will be available in the next day or so. So, if you haven't yet got your version, go ahead and get that one. I'm sure you can find a cheaper version. You can find a free version, in fact. But if you want to support the show, that's a cool way to do it. And in terms of the postage and that kind of thing, because there'll probably be, we'll probably be 2 or 3 or 4 days into the book by the time you receive it. So I would just say, in the meantime, jump online and get one of those free versions of it and read along that way while you wait for your paperback to arrive in the mail. But because it's an Amazon book, it should be quite quick. All right. This is the final chapter of The Brothers Karamazov. Chapter 3, Epilogue. Ilyusha's funeral, the speech at the stone. He really was late. They had waited for him and had already decided to bear the pretty flower-decked little coffin to the church without him. It was the coffin of poor little Ilyusha. He had died 2 days after Mitya was sentenced. At the gate of the house, Alyosha was met by the shouts of the boys, Ilyusha's schoolfellows. They had all been impatiently expecting him and were glad that he had come at last. There were about 12 of them. They all had their school bags or satchels on their shoulders. Father will cry, be with father, Ilyusha had told them as he lay dying, and the boys remembered it. Kolya Krasotkin was the foremost of them. How glad I am you've come, Karamazov, he cried, holding out his hand to Ilyusha. It's awful here. It's really horrible to see it. Snegiryov is not drunk. We know for a fact he's not had nothing to drink today, but he seems as if he were drunk. I am always manly, but this is awful. Karamazov, if I am not keeping you, one question before you go in. What is it, Kolya? Said Alyosha. Is your brother innocent or guilty? Was it he who killed your father, or was it the valet? As you say, so it will be. I haven't slept for the last 4 nights for thinking of it. The valet killed him. My brother is innocent, answered Alyosha. That's what I said Smirov. So he will perish an innocent victim, exclaimed Kolya. Though he is ruined, he is happy. I could envy him. What do you mean? How can you? Why? Cried Alyosha, surprised. Oh, if I too could sacrifice myself some day for truth, said Kolya with enthusiasm, but not in such a cause, not with such a disgrace and such horror, said Alyosha. Of course, I should like to die for all humanity, and as for disgrace, I don't care about that. Our names may perish. I respect your brother. And so do I, the boy, who had once declared that he knew who founded Troy, cried suddenly and unexpectedly, and he blushed up to his ears like a peony, as he had done on that occasion. Alyosha went into the room. Ilyusha lay with his hands folded and his eyes closed in a blue coffin with a white frill around it. His thin face was hardly changed at all, the strange to say that there was no smell of decay from the corpse. The expression of his face was serious and, as it were, thoughtful. His hands crossed over his breast looked particularly beautiful, as though chiselled in marble. There were flowers in his hands and the coffin, with flowers which had been sent early in the morning by Liza Holokov. But there were flowers too from Katerina Ivanovna, and Alyosha opened the door. The captain had a bunch in his trembling hands and was strewing them again over his dear boy. He scarcely glanced at Alyosha when he came in, and he would not look at anyone. Even at his crazy, weeping wife, Mama, who kept trying to stand on her crippled legs to get a nearer look at her dead boy. Nina had been pushed in her chair by the boys close up to the coffin. She sat with her head pressed to it, and she too was no doubt quietly weeping. Snegiryov's face looked eager, yet bewildered and exasperated. There was something crazy about his gestures and the words that broke from him. "Old man, dear old man," he exclaimed every minute, gazing at Ilyusha. It was his habit to call Ilyusha old man as a term of affection when he was alive. Father, give me a flower too, that Take that white one out of his hand and give it to me, the crazy mother begged, whimpering, either because the little white rose in Alicia's hand had caught her fancy or that she wanted one from his hand to keep in memory of him. She moved restlessly, stretching out her hands for the flower. I won't give it to anyone. I won't give you anything, Snegoryov cried callously. They are his flowers, not yours. Everything is his, nothing is yours. Father, give me a flower, said Nina, lifting her face wet with tears. I won't give you anything, and to her, less than anyone. She didn't love Alicia. She took away his little cannon, and he gave it to her. The captain broke into loud sobs at the thought of how Alyosha had given up his cannon to his mother. The poor, crazy creature was bathed in noiseless tears, hiding her face in her hands. The boys, seeing that the father would not leave the coffin and that it was time to carry it out, stood round it in a close circle and began to lift it up. I don't want him to be buried in the churchyard, Snegoryov wailed suddenly. I'll bury him by the stone, by our stone. Alyosha told me to. I won't let him be carried out. He had been saying for the last 3 days that he would bury him by the stone, but Alyosha Krasotkin, the landlady, her sister, and all the boys interfered. What an idea, bury him by an unholy stone, as though he had hanged himself, the old landlady had said sternly. There in the churchyard the ground has been crossed. He'll be prayed for there. One can hear the singing in church, and the deacon reads so plainly and verbally that it will reach him every time, just as though it were read over his grave. At last the captain made a gesture of despair as though to say, take him where you will. The boys raised the coffin, but as they passed the mother they stopped for a moment and lowered it that she might say goodbye to Ilyusha. But on seeing that precious little face, which for the last 3 days she had only looked at from a distance, she trembled all over and her grey head began twitching spasmodically over the coffin. Mother, make the sign of the cross over him. Give him your blessing. Kiss him, Nina cried to her. But her head still twitched like an automaton, and with a face contorted with bitter grief, she began without a word beating her breast with her fist. They carried the coffin past her. Nina pressed her lips to her brother's for the last time as they bore the coffin by her. As Alyosha went out of the house, he begged the landlady to look after those who were left behind, but she interrupted him before he had finished. To be sure, I'll stay with them. We are Christians too. The old woman wept as she said it. They had not far to carry the coffin to the church, not more than 300 paces. It was a still clear day with a slight frost. The church bells were ringing still. Snegoryov ran fussing and distracted after the coffin in his short old summer overcoat, with his head bare and his soft old wide-brimmed hat in his hand. He seemed in a state of bewildered anxiety. At one minute he stretched out his hand to support the head of the coffin and only hindered the bearers. At another he ran alongside and tried to find a place for himself there. A flower fell on the snow, and he rushed to pick it up as though everything in the world depended on the loss of that flower. And the crust of bread. We've forgotten the crust, he cried suddenly. In dismay. But the boys reminded him at once that he had taken the crust of bread already and that it was in his pocket. He instantly pulled it out and was reassured. Ilyusha told me to. Ilyusha, he explained to Alyosha. I was sitting by him one night and he suddenly told me, Father, when my grave is filled up, crumble a piece of bread on it so that the sparrows may fly down. I shall hear it and I shall cheer me up not to be lying alone. That's a good thing, said Alyosha. We must often take some. Every day, said the captain quickly, seeming cheered at the thought. They reached the church at last and set the coffin in the middle of it. The boys surrounded it and remained reverently standing so all through the service. It was an old and rather poor church, rather of the icons. Many of the icons were without settings, but such churches are the best for praying in. During the Mass, Snegoryov became somewhat calmer, though at times he had outbursts of the same unconscious and, as it were, incoherent anxiety. At one moment he went up to the coffin to set straight the cover of the wreath. When a candle fell out of the candlestick, he rushed to replace it and was a fearful time fumbling over it. Then he subsided and stood quietly by the coffin with a look of blank uneasiness and perplexity. After the epistle, he suddenly whispered to Alyosha, who was standing beside him, that the epistle had not been read properly, but did not explain what he meant. During the prayer, like the cherubim, he joined in the singing, but did not go on to the end. Falling on his knees, he pressed his forehead to the stone floor and lay so for a long while. At last came the funeral service itself, and candles were distributed. The distracted father began fussing about again, but the touching and impressive funeral prayers moved and roused his soul. He seemed suddenly to shrink together and broke into rapid short sobs, which he tried at first to smother, but at last he sobbed aloud. When they began taking leave of the dead and closing the coffin, he flung his arms about, as though he would not allow them to cover Ilyusha, and began greedily and persistently kissing his dead boy on the lips. At last they succeeded in persuading him to come away from the step, and suddenly he impulsively stretched out his hand and snatched a few flowers from the coffin. He looked at them, and a new idea seemed to dawn on him, so that he apparently forgot his grief for a minute. Gradually he seemed to sink into brooding and did not resist when the coffin was lifted up and carried to the grave. It was an expensive one in the churchyard close to the church. Katerina Ivanovna had paid for it. After the customary rites, the grave diggers lowered the coffin. Snegoryov, with his flowers in his hand, bent down so low over the open grave that the boys caught hold of his coat in alarm and pulled him back. He did not seem to fully understand what was happening. When they began filling up the grave, he suddenly pointed anxiously at the falling earth and began trying to say something, but no one could make out what he meant, and he stopped suddenly. Then was reminded that he must crumble the bread, and he was awfully excited, snatched up the bread and began pulling it to pieces and flinging the morsels on the grave. "Come, fly down, birds, fly down, sparrows," he muttered anxiously. One of the boys observed that it was awkward for him to crumble the bread with the flowers in his hands, and suggested he should give them to someone to hold for a time, but he would not do this, and seemed indeed suddenly alarmed for his flowers, as though they were wanted to take them from him altogether. And after looking at the grave, and as it were satisfying himself that everything had been done and the bread had been crumpled, he suddenly, to the surprise of everyone, turned quite composedly even, and made his way homewards. But his steps became more and more hurried. He almost ran. The boys and Alyosha kept up with him. "The flowers are for Mama. The flowers are for Mama. I was unkind to Mama," he began exclaiming suddenly. Someone called him to him to put on his hat, as it was cold. But he flung the hat in the snow as though he were angry, and he kept repeating, "I won't have that hat. I won't have the hat." Smirnov picked it up and carried it after him. All the boys were crying, and Kolya and the boy who discovered about Troy most of all. Though Smirnov, with the captain's hat in his hand, was crying bitterly too, he managed as he ran to snatch up a piece of red brick that lay on the snow in the path to fling it at the flock of sparrows that was flying by. He missed them, of course, and went on crying as he ran. Halfway, Snegoryov suddenly stopped, stood still for half a minute or so, struck by something, and suddenly turning back to the church, ran towards the deserted grave. But the boys instantly overtook him and caught hold of him on all sides. Then he fell helpless on the snow as though he had been knocked down, and struggling, sobbing, and wailing, he began crying out, "Ilyusha, old man, dear old man," and Alyosha and Kolya tried to make him get up, soothing and persuading him. "Captain, give over, a brave man must show fortitude," muttered Kolya. You'll spoil the flowers," said Alyosha, "and Mama is expecting them. She is sitting crying because you would not give her any before. Ilyusha's little bed is still there." "Yes, yes, Mama," Snegoryov suddenly recollected. "They'll take away the bed. They'll take it away," he added, as though alarmed that they really would. He jumped up and ran homewards again, but it was not far off, and they all arrived together. Snegoryov opened the door hurriedly and called to his wife, with whom he had so cruelly quarrelled just before. "Mama, poor crippled darling, Ilyusha has sent you these flowers," he cried, holding out to her a little bunch of flowers that had been frozen and broken while he was struggling in the snow. But at that instant he saw in the corner by the little bed Ilyusha's little boots, which the landlady had put tidily side by side. Seeing the old, patched, rusty-looking stiff boots, he flung up his hands and rushed to them, fell on his knees, snatched up one boot, and pressing his lips to it, began kissing it greedily, crying, "Ilyusha, old man, dear old man, where are your little feet? Where have you taken him away? Where have you taken him?" the lunatic cried in a heart-rending voice. Nina, too, broke into sobs. Kolya ran out of the room. The boys followed him. At last Alyosha went out. "Let them weep," he said to Kolya. "It's no use trying to comfort them now. Let wait a few minutes and then go back." "No, it's no use. It's awful," Kolya assented. "Do you know, Karamazov," he dropped his voice so that no one could hear him, "I feel dreadfully sad, and if it were only possible to bring him back, I'd give anything in the world to do it." "Oh, so would I," said Alyosha. "What do you think, Karamazov? Had we better come back here tonight? He'll be drunk, you know. Perhaps he will. Let us come together, and you and I, that will be enough to spend an hour with him, with them, with the mother and Nina. If we all come together, we shall remind them of everything again," Alyosha suggested. "The landlady is laying the table for them now. They'll be back. There'll be a funeral dinner or something. The priest is coming. Shall we go back to it, Karamazov?" "Of course," said Alyosha. "It's so strange, Karamazov, such sorrow and then pancakes after it. It's all so unnatural in our religion. They are going to have salmon too," the boy who had discovered about Troy. Sorry about my phone beeping. I thought it was on silent. The boy who had discovered about Troy observed in a loud voice, "I beg you most earnestly, Kartashov, not to interrupt again with your idiotic remarks, especially when one is not talking to you and doesn't care to know whether you exist or not," Kolya snapped out irritably. The boy flushed crimson but did not dare reply. Meanwhile, they were strolling slowly along the path, and suddenly Smirnov exclaimed, "There's Ilyusha's stone, under which they wanted to bury him." They all stood still by the big stone. Ilyusha looked, and the whole picture of what Smirnov had described to him that day, how Ilyusha, weeping and hugging his father, had cried, "Father, father, how he insulted you," rose at once before his imagination. A sudden impulse seemed to come into his soul. With a serious and earnest expression, he looked from one to another of the bright, pleasant faces in Ilyusha's schoolfellows, and suddenly said to them, "Boys, I should like to say one word to you here at this place." The boys stood around him and at once bent attentive and expectant eyes upon him. "Boys, we shall soon part. I shall be for some time with my two brothers, of whom one is going to Siberia and the other is lying at death's door. But soon I shall leave this town, perhaps for a long time, so we shall part. Let us make a compact here at Ilyusha's stone that we will never forget Ilyusha and one another. And whatever happens to us later in life, if we don't meet for 20 years afterwards, let us always remember how we buried the poor boy at whom we once threw stones, do you remember, by the bridge, and afterwards we all grew so fond of him. He was a fine boy and kind-hearted, brave boy. He felt for his father's honour and resented the cruel insult to him and stood up for him. And so in the first place we will remember him, boys, all our lives. And even if we are occupied with most important things, if we attain to honour or fall into great misfortune, still let us remember how good it was once here when we were all together, united by a good and kind feeling which made us, for the time we were loving that poor boy, better, perhaps, than we are. My little doves, let me call you so, for you are very like them, those pretty blue birds, at this minute, as I look at your good dear faces. My dear children, perhaps you won't understand what I am saying to you, because I often speak very unintelligibly, but you'll remember all the same and will agree with my words sometime. You must know that there is nothing higher and stronger and more wholesome and good for life in the future than some good memory, especially a memory of childhood, of home. People talk to you a great deal about your education, but some good sacred memory preserved from childhood is perhaps the best education. If a man carries many such memories with him into life, he is safe to end of his days. And if one has only one good memory left in one's heart, even that may sometimes be a means to saving us. Perhaps we may even grow wicked later on, may be unable to refrain from a bad action, may laugh at men's tears and at those people who say, as Kolya did just now, "I want to suffer for all men," and may even jeer spitefully at such people. But however bad we may become, which God forbid, yet when we recall how we buried Ilyusha, how we loved him in his last days, and how we have been talking like friends all together at his stone, the cruelest and most mocking of us, if we do become so, we would dare not to laugh inwardly at having been kind and good at this moment. What's more, perhaps that one memory may keep him from greater evil, and he will reflect and say, "Yes, I was good and brave and honest then." Let him laugh to himself. That's no matter. A man often laughs at what's good and kind. That's only from thoughtlessness. But I assure you, boys, that as he laughs, he will say at once in his heart, "No, I do wrong to laugh, and for that's not a thing to laugh at." "That will be so, I understand you, Karamazov," cried Kolya with flashing eyes. The boys were excited, and they too wanted to say something, but they restrained themselves, looking at with intentness and emotion at the speaker. "I say this is in case we become bad," Alyosha went on, "but there's no reason why we should become bad, is there, boys? Let us be first and above all kind, then honest, and let us never forget each other. I say that again. I give you my word for my part that I'll never forget one of you. Every face looking at me now I shall remember for even for 30 years. Just now Kolya said to Kartashov that we did not care to know whether he exists or not, but I cannot forget that Kartashov exists, and that he is not blushing now as he did when he discovered the founders of Troy, but is looking at me with his joy, jolly, kind, dear little eyes. Boys, my dear boys, let us all be generous and brave like Ilyusha, clever, brave, and generous like Kolya, though he will be ever so much cleverer when he is grown up. And let us all be as modest, as clever, and sweet as Kartashov, But why am I talking about those two? You are all dear to me, boys. From this day forth, I have a place in my heart for all of you, and I beg you to keep a place in your hearts for me. Well, and who has united us in this kind, good feeling, which we shall remember and intend to remember for all our lives? Who, if not Ilyusha, the good boy, the dear boy, precious to us forever, let us never forget him. May his memory live forever in our hearts from the first this time forth. Yes, yes, forever, forever. The boys cried in their ringing voices with softened faces. Let us remember his face and his clothes and his poor little boots, his coffin and his unhappy sinful father, who boldly he stood up for him alone against the whole school. We will remember, we will remember, cried the boys. He was brave, he was good. Ah, how I loved him, exclaimed Kolya. Our children, our dear friends, don't be afraid of life. How good life is when one does something good and just. Yes, yes, the boys repeated enthusiastically. Karamazov, we love you, a voice probably, Karatashov's cried impulsively, probably Karatashov's. We love you, they all caught it up. There were tears in the eyes of many of them. Hurrah for Karamazov, Kolya shouted ecstatically. And may the dead boy's memory live forever, Alyosha added again with feeling. Forever, the boys chimed in again. Karamazov, cried Kolya, can it be true what's taught us in religion, that we shall all rise again from the dead and shall live and see each other again, all Ilyusha too? Certainly we shall all rise again, certainly we shall see each other and shall tell each other with joy and gladness all that has happened, Ilyusha answered, half laughing, half enthusiastic. Ah, how splendid it will be, broke from Kolya. Well, now we will finish talking and go to his funeral dinner. Don't be put out at our eating pancakes. It's very old custom, and there's something nice in that, laughed Alyosha. Well, let us go, and now we go hand in hand. And always so, all our lives hand in hand. Hurrah for Karamazov, Kolya cried once more rapturously, and once more the boys took up his exclamations. Hurrah for Karamazov. The end. Oh my God. All right, well, the worst book I've ever read has the worst ending for a book I've ever read. Have your say about the Brothers Karamazov at Reddit. I look forward to seeing what you made of that. Thanks for listening. We'll start a new book tomorrow. So, hey, I'll see you tomorrow to start off The Enormous Room by E.E. Cummings. Can't get any worse. I'm looking forward to this. See you tomorrow.